stand beside me. We're better as a unit. Ain't enough bullets in a gun to hit us all.
Hey, so what's up, everybody? Back here for another episode of Code Switch. It's your boy Trevor Evans. Here with my boy, I call him Hollywood, but Emmanuel Buckley, his colleagues also call him EB for short.
So good people.
Yeah. So before we kind of go into the episode today, Hollywood, do we maybe want to give a brief intro of ourselves again for the folks who maybe haven't seen the first episode?
Yeah. So welcome team, good people. I am Emmanuel Buckley. I am a software engineering manager. I've been doing this for about, or been in the industry for about over a decade now. But yeah, I manage a few teams, a few people, have experience there, have experience being a team lead and just coming up in the industry, you know, as a junior, not knowing anything, just very ambitious to really, really, really get ahead and start learning things to turn it into more of a mentor and leader at work and in this field.
Awesome. Appreciate that, man. So I'll go into kind of my background a little bit. Trevor Evans. I also work in the software engineering field. Right, currently I'm in an IC role, but I have been in management in the past, similar to Hollywood. Hollywood is my mentor, whether he likes to admit it or not. He loves to give me a lot of credit, but he definitely helped me get to where I am today. So about a decade of experience under my belt in full stack development. Currently doing more front end at this time, but I also still dabble in the back end and also kind of looking to get back into the leadership realm here in the near future. So yeah, let's just go ahead and jump into our episode for today. So the topic for today is failure ain't final, lessons from projects that didn't make it. So to all of my tech people out there, I'm pretty sure you are familiar with various projects, various technologies that you've probably dabbled in on the side apart from your 9-to-5. I'm sure you've probably had some real dope ideas of, oh, you know, I have this idea for this project. Maybe you put together a team, maybe you got with a friend, maybe it was something very serious, you know, maybe someone came to you with an idea for a project and you worked through it. And as we all experience, sometimes they fall through, you know, they don't work out the way that you plan. And so we want to kind of go into that a little bit on this episode and talk about, you know, what are some projects that we have failed at? What are some things we could have done differently, things we could have done better, and just reflecting on that, you know. But before we jump into that, what I want to do is kind of take a step back and take it to my roots, which is the Bible. You know, I'm real big on God, real big on Christianity. So I love to kind of just set the foundation. So I found a scripture here, Hollywood, Proverbs 24, chapter 1 through 16 verse. Now, I'm not going to read through all of that. You know, I'm not going to take y'all through a morning sermon here, but it talks about wisdom.
Sure, let me know if we need to. Let me know if I need to stand up, man, when you're reading. So.
hey, you got it, you got it. If you need a little bit more time, let me know.
Be with me, say nah, amen.
So basically, it just talks about wisdom, knowledge, and trying to stay away from evildoers and foolishness. But how this kind of pertains to failure, in my opinion, there were a few verses in here that really spoke to me. Specifically, verse 10. So I'll read that. It says, if thou faint in the day of adversity, thy strength is small. And then verse 16, for a just man falleth 7 times and riseth up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. So that really spoke to me and just said, you know, when you're working through projects, even outside of projects, just in life, you know, as you're working through things, you know, you're going to have to persevere. There are going to be times where you're dealing with challenges, where you're dealing with adversities, you know, and you have to know how to get back up, brush the dust off, and keep it pushing, you know. And Proverbs is just a real good book for uplifting inspiration. So I encourage all of y'all, go check that out. Proverbs 24, chapter 1 through the 16th verse. We learn a lot through failure, right? especially within our community. And failure disproportionately affects people without access to resources or strong networks. So the reason I say that, Hollywood, is I feel like within our community, we're in a place where I've even seen it in my hometown where if someone messes up, like, I'm gonna give you a good example. I knew a lot of people from my high school that either they, you know, messed up, went to jail, or maybe they got pregnant, had a kid, and it's over for them. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of people I know from my hometown had kids, and they never made it out. They were never able to go to college. They were never able to get, like, a stable trade. And since then, like, I feel like I've been able to go on and do all of these great things, you know, doing well for myself. But I look back, and it's like, wow, yeah, like, sure, they had a kid, and I understand, right? Like, that's a big deal. But it's not like I wasn't out here, you know, talking to girls and doing all those things, you know? And I'm pretty sure people from other communities with more privilege are doing the same things at those ages. But they're able to bounce back because of that privilege, because of maybe what their family has and the resources that they have around them. So they can make those mistakes and still go on to be very successful. But I feel like within our community, it's like, oh man, you done had a baby, it's over with, you know? And then from that point on, you're basically in your hometown. You're just trying your best to find those opportunities and move up within your community, but there's already not a lot of resources in that community. So that's one thing that I think about as far as failure and how it pertains to our community. I feel like we really have this marginalized line that we have to walk, because the moment we mess up, it's disastrous for us.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I would say this, you mentioned something, privilege, right? And I would say privilege is disproportionately proportioned across communities, right? So there are privileged people across all communities, obviously, right? It's just that some communities have a lot more of it than we do. And so when you talk about the hate affects us more, is because our part of the reason is because that, like you and me, to a certain extent, we have privileged lives. You really think about it, and you go back to the Bible, right? Like, a lot of people pray for us, man. We had a lot of people who had strong foundation and strong roots in the church. We had a lot of people around us like that would knock us on top of our head, right? Hey, no, that's not the right thing to do. So even though that we may experience those things, that we've had that support system where other people, unfortunately, have not. I have never had a child. I don't have any kids, but I can only imagine just having a child at such a young age and then having to go back home, or maybe not even having a home to go back to with no support. And so now you're like, your only job and your only task is to keep this child alive and healthy and moving on to the next phase in life. It is unfortunate within our community, man. I hope that, I hope that we get to a place where we start looking at people as resources versus opportunities. I do, you know, kind of touch on the last episode. I do think that's very prevalent in our community, right? And even with, like, when I say opportunities, not even trying to make money off of them. But one thing that a lot of young people, I will say, I'll frame it that way, they like a bunch of foolishness. If you think about our roles in life and our normal position as Black people in life, we're typically either athletes or we're entertainers. And not everybody are going to be athletes, right? So easy to be entertainers, easy to go onto social media and act a fool, right? And have people laugh at you, know, get your views or laugh at other people, right? So it's unfortunate, man.
Yeah, so that brings forth kind of a question in my mind. How do you convince the younger generation from our community that you don't have to go that route? Because I'll be honest with you, when I was in high school, I'll be honest with you, man, I was looking at all the athletes on TV, I was looking at the rappers, I was looking at the producers, and I was like, man, I was like, that would be fun, you know? Didn't even know, like, in 10th, 11th grade, I would go on to be, like, in the engineering community so heavily, right? But here we are, you know what I'm saying? And it truly has been a blessing, you know? But how do you convince the younger generation to say, hey, man, like, there's another way?
That's a good question. I don't think I had an answer. I would say this, and you break up another good point, right? I think I could almost bet my bank account that most of us have dropped at least one verse in our younger years, right?
100%.
At least one rap. We came up with at least one, right? trying to find a way to make it out.
Facts.
But I think my philosophy has changed to, I have to focus on the people who want to make it out, right? Focus on the people who have that desire to just really get ahead and just don't have the opportunities to do so. Because you can talk to everybody, and I don't think we should not talk to everybody, just to be very clear. I think we should talk to everybody and pour into everybody, but the focus should really be on those who really, really, really are trying and just haven't, you know, found their way out. I think in a lot of cases in just life in general, across all cultures and things like that, we tend to focus on the people who don't really want anything extra in life. So, those are examples of why we don't do the certain things that we do in life, kind of going back to church, right? You have a lot of people say, well, I don't go to church because, you know, that's how church people act. Well, you're focused on the wrong people. First off, you shouldn't be focused on the people at all, right? In that church, you should be focused on the people who are actually doing what they say that they do and living life or trying to live life how they should be living it, versus you focus on the maybe the minority, maybe the majority of people, but regardless, you're focusing on people who, in the grand scheme of things, don't really live how they talk.
Yeah, I like what you said about focusing on, you know, the people that want to get out, right? There's bringing it back to the Bible here. I believe there's like a scripture that's, I don't remember it verbatim, but it says something along the lines of, you know, when you're trying to, you know, reach people and, you know, share the gospel with them and tell them about Christ and God and all those things, you know, it talks about how you're going to get pushback. You're going to get people that don't want to hear it, you know, but I believe it says, shake the dust off of your feet, something like that, you know, but basically it speaks to, you know, move on, you know, like you just said, it's not that you don't share with everyone, but you don't get hung up on the people that aren't receiving it, you know, and you move forward with the ones that are willing to receive it. So really like what you said there, man. Really like what you said there. So went off script a little bit, but that was a good conversation. So another point I have here about how failure disproportionately affects people, particularly from our community, is our expectations implicitly higher because of who we are and who might not want us to be in higher places or higher positions. What are your thoughts on that?
The expectation is higher. I have to agree. I have to agree. Mm-hmm. And I'll frame it this way, right? You know, we have a lot of friends who aren't necessarily Christian, just bringing it back to the Bible again, who not Christian, right? Still cool, very, very close friends too.
Right.
Man, I bring it up to say that the way that people view Christians is that they hold us to a very high standard. They hold us to perfection. True. If you really think about it, they hold us to perfection. Remember, to be Christians, to be Christ-like. Christ is perfect. You're holding us to that we'll never achieve. So bringing it back to something I said in the last episode, which was that I feel like I represent all Black people as far as my behavior and things like that. I don't think other communities, this is how I feel, I don't think other communities have that same expectation of themselves. The expectation is higher. You need to hold yourself in a higher esteem or to a higher standard than what other people may or may not require. You're already not in a lot of places. And so you can't falter, because if you do, the chances of another person that looks like you get into that place may not be as likely in the future. And so I don't think other communities have that same standard of them. And just to be clear, nobody has ever said this to me, right? It's just a feeling. It's just from experience, from what I've seen. And so I'm not saying that, hey, this is law. This is the true standard of us. But just from historical purposes, that's what it feels like, right? Like we didn't have to, certain people didn't have to prove themselves to be here to say, hey, you know, we need the right to vote. We need the right to be able to have quality education, go to the same schools with the same standards, be able to use the same bathrooms, et cetera, et cetera. And man, people had like this a long time ago. This is not a long time ago. My grandma grew up during these times, right? So I do think that that standard does permutate across all our community to some extent.
100%, man. And you talk about it not being long ago. That's facts because my parents that are boomers, like they actually like when like segregation ended while they were like in school. You know what I'm saying? So like they literally. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So they literally witnessed, you know, being kids and being in a segregated environment. And then, you know, as they're growing, it's like, whoa, everything changed. Now you're integrated, you know. And I feel like we sweep that under the rug a lot, right? Like, especially depending on who you talk to, you know, you're in these conversations and they try to throw it back like, oh, well, you know, that was so long ago. You know, that wasn't me. That's not how I feel. That's not how I think. And I'm like, well, I'm not saying you think that way, but I'm just saying we need to have the conversation, right? Because these things are still very much prevalent. And I mean, these things are not things that are going to change overnight. And if they just happened, you know, we still have to do the work to continue diluting that, right?
Yep. Context matters. That's what people don't understand. Context matters.
Facts. One thing I this popped in my brain as you were talking, but I'll never forget back when we were at RSI, bro, and I was on limbs. You remember Don? Oh, I know. Lil's was wild, right? Okay, all right. So I guess we need to probably maybe pause here, give the watchers what LIMS stands for, Laboratory Information Management System. And I'll never forget, bro. I was in Dothan. For those that don't know, I'm from Dothan, Alabama. And I was in Dothan. I graduated just trying to apply for jobs, trying to find something, and came across this opportunity for it. An associate programmer analyst at a company called Rural Sourcing Inc., RSI. And I applied. They hit me up. I do the interview. And they're like, yeah, they were like, we're gonna bring you in. And for the first 6 months, we want you to be working on something called LIMS. And they were like, after that, we're going to move you on to something either Java or .NET, but we're going to get you into something that you're probably a little more familiar with. But we're going to teach you this new programming language. So they called it a programming language, right? Then I get there. It's not a programming language at all. It's a system. It's a system that allows for data entry and configuration management. That was pretty much it. You can do some SQL. You could do like some Visual Basic. But it in and of itself, it was not a programming language. It wasn't like a framework or anything like that. And so, and I ended up staying on there longer than 6 months. So I was very upset about that. And Hollywood will tell y'all, I had a couple blowouts while I was at RSI behind.
No, it's called crashing out now, man. It's called crashing out.
Yeah, I crashed out a good couple times. But I don't know if you remember Robbie Yant, Hollywood. Robbie. Okay, man. Yeah.
Oh, redhead Robbie. Out. Redhead Robbie. Oh yeah, I remember. I was
not
there
him.
That
not
day.
Him.
Oh.
No, it was a different Robbie. He was on LIMS, but he was a similar position as me. Mm-hmm. Like he wanted to code, and they put him on a LIMS project, and he crashed out pretty good too on Courtney. So.
I remember Redhead Robbie. He crashed out. I was there when he crashed out. I was there when they walked him out.
Yeah.
RSI was wild.
Yeah. So
hey,
for y'all,
but look, Trey,
that's how
look,
me. And how, what
you got? You don't forget the pizza parties though. They gave y'all pizza
parties. No, or the victory cake.
Oh, that's not.
Hey. Oh man, man,
that,
oh,
that's
man.
Gonna have to so, be yeah, that's gonna have to be a topic on success, bro. Like we're gonna.
We should maybe do an episode on like previous jobs and like some of the fallacies or something like that. But I don't know if we get in trouble name dropping companies. I'm not sure.
I mean, it is what it is at this point. Hey, look, we here now.
But facts. But to fill y'all in, that's where I met Hollywood, and that's how he became my mentor. That's how I got into .NET development. But anyway, do you remember Don Hollywood from on Off the Limbs team?
Nah, I remember. All
okay,
people,
all right. He was the second older guy next to John Klaus. But anyway, one time I was talking with Don. They had an interview, and him and John they go to the interview. Don comes back and he's like, yeah, this guy, you know, he was real professional, but he was like. He didn't really look put together, right? But he didn't give any like hardcore details. And then he started saying like the guy had a lot of hair, you know. And he was like he needs to have like a clean look, you know, get a haircut, things like that. So I do not know what ethnicity this guy was. Don never really he never revealed that. But based on the way he was talking, I kind of got the impression that he might have been a person of color. And I feel like that goes back to, you know, these higher standards for us, because it's like, wow, just because he had longer hair, is that a problem? You know, just because it looks different than maybe what you're used to seeing, you know, because probably in your circle of people, your circle of influence, everybody might have either like a lower cut, or maybe they have long hair, but it's slicked back and maybe it's of a different texture. But maybe because this person came in and maybe they had braids or dreads, maybe a mini fro or something like that, maybe even a fro, but as long as it's very neat, like to me, that's not a problem, you know. But obviously it wasn't working for Don. And of course that guy ended up not getting hired. Right. So I feel like that goes back to those are one of the tangible examples of like, for us, like expectations have to be higher to where we even have to like watch what our hair looks like, you know, like for certain employers, it's a problem, you know, versus people of other ethnicities, you know, where they have certain textures with their hair, like they just give it two combs, walk in there, you know, and they're good to go, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. Part of the story behind my locks, right, is part of that, right? I wanted to be able to show that, hey, professionalism looks different for different people. It doesn't all look one way. And let me brag on a company real quick. So I think most companies actually fall short in their hiring practices. Definitely that's an instance of one. But I want to brag on Amazon. I used to work at Amazon for a few years, AWS in security. Mm-hmm. And their hiring practices, I will say, to me, are some of the best hiring practices. And I think they are the model behind the hiring practices. The reason why I say that is because you are interviewed by at least five people, 4 to 5 people. Mm-hmm. And they are very, very intentional about making sure that those people that you are interviewing with are of a diverse set of skills and looks and ethnicities and gender, right? The reason why that's important, awesome, is because I can view you one way, and a white male can view you a different way, and a white female can view you a different way. And you all come into these rooms and making sure that you all are focusing on the facts and not just how you were perceived in that interview. Yeah. Right. Because I could come off as, you know, aggressive, cocky, confident, timid, like various different ways, right, to different people. And so they do a very, very good job, in my opinion, of really, really getting diverse sets of groups of people in those rooms and having tough conversations. Like these are tough conversations, too. These are not just, oh, well, they fit in. That's not going to fly. Right. Like if you say somebody fits in, they're going to ask you to explain what you mean by fitting in, because I may fit into some groups and not others. Right. And vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I do really like their hiring practice. But that's an example, to your point, that's an example from RSI or whoever it was, that, hey, you know, you don't have the right people in the room, or you don't have enough people in the room.
Bingo, enough people in the room. And a sidebar really quick. I really, really, really want to see more black people in tech because of, and I thought about this because you talked about how good AWS's interview practices are. And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but do you know if there were a healthy amount of black people in on interview panels?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the diverse set. When I was there, it typically was just me, right? Which is fairly normal.
Right.
But I do know that when I, because I could see the interview loops and I could see the people that were on there, I do know that it was not all white males, right? That's a fact.
That's awesome.
It was a good group of women that was there as well.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And that's one thing that I feel like I'm seeing more and more selection of at least white women. Like, so the last company I was at, not my current, but WEX, the CEO was a white woman. They promoted a white woman to engineering manager, which was awesome. I think now I'm currently looking at this one place, and the VP is a female, so that's awesome. So I feel like I'm seeing more representation, at least from the white female side, but I definitely want to see more black people in tech because, to your point, Hollywood, and I've experienced that as well. My time at WEX, where I'm at currently, where I've been at in the past, like it's just not a lot of us in those spaces. So, and that's part of the reason why we did this podcast, right? To hopefully try to create some noise and disruption and get some more of us in that space, man. So, all right, cool. So kind of moving on here, I have a quick little stat that I want to bring up really quick. So, and then we'll kind of go into some projects. So I just went online and researched, and I was like, how often do like startups fail, you know, to try to reflect like how often does this happen where people have like an idea or they work on a project and it falls through. So I found this little stat, and it says up to 90% of startups fail. Across almost all industries, the average failure rate for year one is 10%. But listen to this. However, in years 2 through 5, a staggering 70% of new businesses will fail. So that was just a little stat I wanted to throw out there just to show like it happens a lot, bro, where people try to work on a project and it just falls through, man. And I think it's for a myriad of reasons, man. And then the big thing, I don't know if this is going to get your blood boiling, but I wanted to kind of talk about an experience we had, which is Coder Dojo. So I'll fill the watchers in real quick. So, what year was that, man? When we did Coder, was that 2018? 20?
I don't remember 17? The year. I can tell you what I do remember. Whatever year it was, I only had a mattress and it was on the floor. I didn't even have a headboard. So, I don't remember where
but
I was,
but you were in Destin.
I think
you
I was
in
Destin,
Portland. Right?
I think I was in Portland.
Oh wow! So that had maybe to be like 2018, 2019, maybe.
2019, 2020, somewhere around there, I believe.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, so we have a friend of ours. His name is Josh. Hopefully we'll have him on here at some point in the near future. He also works in tech. Very bright guy. Also very charismatic. But Josh basically came to Hollywood where someone had reached out to him about building out this app for a nonprofit, right? Coder Dojo.
Yeah.
So basically, Coder Dojo, my understanding is, I don't know if they're still out there today, but my understanding is they basically were a nonprofit where they would teach younger people how to code. And so they approached Josh about building out this app. So they wanted a website, and then they also wanted a portal where they could log in and the students could submit their assignments. They could look at the assignments and they could, you know, have, all, you know, kind of this traditional teaching workflow, if you will. And so Josh hit up Hollywood. Hollywood hit me up. So all three of us, we kind of, you know, had a little chat. We were like, all right, cool. Boom, boom, boom. We're going to work on this project. Well, ended up falling through. And that was a super, It was super disappointing for me because that was the first side project I ever worked on where someone was like asking for what we were working on. Typically, you have a good idea or maybe you have a problem that you run into and you're like, oh, you know, light bulb goes off and you're like, I could build something to solve this problem. Or maybe you just have a cool idea and you just want to dabble with some technology. So you're like, oh, cool, I'm going to just build this app. This was the first time where someone was coming to us and saying, hey, we need this. Can you guys do it? So when it fell through, I was like, man, that really was heartbreaking because I was like, dang, man, like that would have looked good on my resume. You know what I'm saying? And then if it would have kept going, you could still go back to it today and just be like, man, look at that. We built that. They're still using it. You know what I'm saying? Yep. Maybe you down the road, you enhance it. But it fell through, man. It fell through. So I wanted to kind of reflect on that project for a little bit, man, and ask what happened. Why do we think it failed?
So I have strong opinions about that, but I think that the reason why it failed was lack of communication from both sides, right? I'll take some ownership, right, from our side and say, hey, you know, we could have communicated better, right? I mean, we were young, younger, and the more I think about it, I think it was actually 2018, somewhere around there, because I think we were just like, we were young, right? Like, I mean, a lot younger than we are. You know, you kind of mature, obviously, over time, right? At least hopefully you do. And can kind of reflect back on moments. But holistically looking at it, I think that communication was just not great from both sides. It really started with that they wanted us to do the front end portion, right? It was the whole thing.
Yeah. They wanted a website. That was kind of more of a, I think the website was supposed to be more static, if you will.
But the
web app was like full stack.
Yeah. And so, The thing about that is, I didn't personally own the communication chain. Like Josh owned the communication chain with that person. You know, they had a relationship and things like that. And knowing Josh, how I know him, I guarantee you he communicated out like, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what we're building and whatever. If I'm not mistaken, I do remember that there were sometimes I reach out to Josh, like, hey, what's going on? Like, can we demo this? Can we get some feedback, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, I can't even get in touch with that person. And so, lo and behold, after we get somewhat done, right? Because we at some point you need guidance, right? You need your favorite phrase. What are the requirements, right? So you know, we had, you know, some general idea of the requirements, but you know, like, is this going down the path that you expected to go down? Because we may need to switch it up, or we may need to build things differently. And we never really heard back from them. And then by the time that we did, I think I had taken over the direct communication chain. We heard like I was able to just talk one-on-one or whatever for various reasons. And then I'll never forget, it was the meeting. The meeting where it just kind of just all ended, right? We all want to call. At least me and Josh want to call, but I think we all want to call. And they were like, so we work with this other company to build the portal back end. Can you all just work on the front end and then wire it up to the back end? I can't really I don't have enough time to articulate how complex something like that may or may not be. I can tell you is that was not what was on the table. Remember this, all this has been done for free. Like we're not getting paid for any of this, right? And that's fine. We knew that up front, so I'm not using that as an excuse. But what we agreed upon was not what we agreed upon. So now you're asking us to go do a lot more work and in-depth research on how hooking up two different two different systems and make it all one experience. And I remember her response, because I don't know how I reacted on the call. I'm pretty sure it was very direct though. And I'll never forget her response to whatever I had said. She said, well, I think she said like Dell or Google does it or something like that. And in my head, the only thing I saw was, we're not Google. Like whoever she compared us to, that's not who we are. Not that we can do it. Again, just not that we can do it. We were doing it for free. You have to go pay the people that you're talking about or you're comparing this to. Right. You're not paying us to do this. Like, and so that kind of fizzled out. So I would say to summarize it, I think communication was poor on both sides, but I do think that obviously bias, it wasn't most of our communication.
I completely agree with that. Like, I think ultimately, like, they kind of, they slighted us, right? Like, they kind of cut our legs from underneath us. I don't really know why, in reflection, why they even went off and did that. Like, do you remember if she explained why they even did that?
I don't know. I have a theory, though. I think they were working with multiple people, multiple groups of people. And so potentially what they saw was, hey, they saw our front end work, because Maria did both. They saw our front end work. So, hey, that's cool. We like that. But we like this back end portal that this other team has done. And we're going to try to see if we can maneuver our way in here and say, hey, let's just hook up both systems versus, hey, just being straight out honest with us. Hey, we actually like what they did better and we're going to go with them. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And see that. That wound up in a lot of wasted time. I think that was a big thing, at least for me. Like, I was like, wow. I'm like, so you're basically asking us to just toss out all this stuff we did. Like, I don't know if you remember, but I wrote all of the authentication and the authorization. Like, and I mean, this was before, you know, now, you know, the recommendation is like, oh, you go with the, and you know, a provider like Auth0 or Clerk or whatever. But this was back when, you know, man, you were just hand rolling things, you know? So, like, I'm just using all, like, straight.net, you know, whatever they offer, you know? So, I'm like, man, that was a lot. That was a lot of code, a lot of logic that a lot of love I put into that, you know what I'm saying? And don't get it wrong. Like, I'm not the type of engineer that, handcuffs myself to some code, you know? Like, I believe strongly in, like, hey, let's improve where we can improve. And if something isn't the right solution, let's get rid of it. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of wasted time. You know what I'm saying? And at what point do you say, okay, like you said, we're doing this for free. And now I'm at a loss on my time. So now we're really in the red. You know, we're really in the red.
How I frame like loss of time and a waste of time for me. Because even if I'm doing projects right, I can, and I think you're gonna get to this, but we can learn something from them. I can actually honestly say, truly, hand on the Bible, I learned nothing new out of doing Coda Jojo, and that was the biggest waste of time for me. And because there are a lot of projects I actually learned a lot from, but Coda Jojo.
Yeah, yeah, and so like, and now I'm going on a tangent here a little bit, but I think it also translates even to the industry, like even outside of just like side projects, right? Like even in your like day-to-day work, how many times is time lost behind situations where stakeholders are just not clear, breakdown on communication? And I'm gonna try to say this without people catching strays, but certain context being lost between stakeholder and product communication. You know, like stakeholders say A, product interprets that as B, product comes to tech with C. And then the reality is what they really need is D. So between all of that, we really have not even identified what they really need. And now you build something, similar situation. Oh, hey, here you go. And they're like, this isn't what we need. Oh, okay. Yeah. So once again, now I got to go toss this out.
Yeah. What if I threw this at you? What if I say there is not enough wasted time that actually happens in the field? And what I mean by that is, you know, you just describe, hey, we take this and we toss it out. How many times, though, do companies say, we're not going to toss it out, we're just going to build upon something that we don't need and build something quote unquote better, but we all know how that all turns out. It actually turns out worse. Now that's really a lot of waste of time, because you're building on top of tech debt, you're building on top of really trash to try to get something valuable out of it.
So you bring up a great point, and I'm actually now I'm really about to go off subject here a little bit, because at my current job, I actually just ran into this. So we have this consultant where, we have this client where they basically brought to us like this code base, it was bad. And they had two different UI code bases and they were like, hey, can you guys consolidate it into one? Now, the code was already a big mess, right? Like, and they told us, like, openly, they were like, hey, we generated this using AI. They're not tech people, you know? So yeah. They generated this thing and, but they're actually making revenue, you know? So right off the bat, I'm like, okay, cool. I'm not about to sit here and try to consolidate this. We're just going to build it from the ground up, you know? Mind you, at this time, I'm new. So I don't have any idea of like what the funding is, what our time frame is roughly. I don't have any of that. But basically they bring me in. They're like, hey, you know, we don't have a whole lot of UI experience. You do. Lead us to the promised land. So I'm like, okay, bet. I'm like, I'm going to do some mock-ups. And they're like, that's great. So I'm not a Figma type of guy, you know, because I don't like the concept of like dealing with these boxes and all this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's a lot easier if I just code it up.
Yeah. So yeah.
I coded up this UI. But once again, it's a mock-up. So I code up these mock-ups, I show them to everybody, they're like, yeah, that's great. So then I get pulled onto another project briefly. There's another person that was slotted for that project. So I go off work on this other thing briefly. I come back, Hollywood. They done took the stuff I did for the mock-ups. That's production code now. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, that was not the... I literally had in the mock-up, like I had put like an element that said for prototype purposes only. Bro, they literally had that in the environment. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, that was not the intention.
Yeah.
So guess what? So now we rolling with what I did from the first day, you know, and I'm like, all right, yep. I guess this is what it is, you know?
Yep. If somebody's going to take that, right? Something doesn't work on it, and they're going to say, okay, well, let me build on top of this rather than, again, taking a step back and let's build something new. Like people, the like companies want to quote unquote move fast. Right. And I don't believe that.
Right.
You can move fast and have quality software. I just want to be clear. I'm not saying you have to move slow, mm-hmm. but I don't think you can just move fast and be like, hey, we need to move fast and we need quality.
Yeah.
The reason why I don't believe that is because I don't believe companies actually invest in the idea. Cause if they did, they would bring more people in, to quote unquote move fast and improve the quality. But not to go on that tangent, but I always tell my people, this is that, or my teams is that I am more focused on doing the right work and not saving work, right? Like if we built something and that's not what is needed and we need to go back and redo it, like let's have that conversation of let's get rid of this application. Let's go back and build it from the ground. Let's take a step back, build it from the ground up. And then once we build it the right way, we can move faster later because we can improve upon the right stuff. You know how difficult it is to improve on bad code? Like that is absolutely,
yes.
I mean, it brings so much risk too, because a lot of bad code is not real documented, right? And even if, you know, code's supposed to be self-documenting, some people self-documenting, you look at it like, how'd you even document this? Like you wrote this, you documented it,
right?
And you kept it. Like, I don't understand these three, right? Like, you didn't read what you wrote. It's crazy.
So I remember this, I won't say quote per se, but Matt Roberts, your mentor, actually kind of taught me this. I kind of augmented what he said, but I have this thing that sticks with me, which is quality, speed, and budget. You can only have two. you're not going to get all three. And I feel like senior leaders, that's what they try to tout, right? Especially now with like this AI hype, like they try to say, oh, you should be able to be 150% to 200% productive. You know, like you should be able to 1x, 2x your productivity, you know, and I'm just like, that's not reality, you know. So I hold strong to that sentiment, which is speed, quality, and budget. Pick two out of the three. We can be fast. And we can get it done under budget, but the quality's not going to be there.
Yeah. Oh,
hey, man, that's just.
I think if people were honest, though, I think if they had to sacrifice something, they would sacrifice quality. Right? Like if you were to ask a leader to sacrifice something, they're going to sacrifice. They might not say it, right?
They're not going to say it, right? But in reality, that's sacrificing quality. Because their whole thing is, guess what? I don't see the code. I see the product, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I care about the product. And guess what? If something happens with the product, we're just going to call you late at night and you're going to get up because we pay you. So you're going to get up and you're going to fix it.
Yep.
That's just reality.
I think part of the reason too, right, is that it's very difficult to correlate quality to revenue. So if you can always say, hey, you know, you can do numbers with budget. You can do numbers with actually having a product out there. Say, hey, I got this product out there, no matter the quality, and it's bringing in some type mm-hmm. of revenue. But you can't go and say, well, if I improve the quality to, let's say, 90% or something like that, how much more revenue is that going to generate? It's very difficult to ascertain.
Yeah. 100%. And maybe when we do an episode on AI, because, y'all, we do have some stuff slotted for that. But maybe when we talk about that, I would love to dive into, like, do we feel like in the future quality isn't even a thing? Like, I mean, you got to think about it, Hollywood. We 10, 15 years in the game, man. Like, are the next wave of engineers, are they going to be kind of mentored to think in more of a mindset that quality doesn't matter that much? You know what I'm saying? Especially, I mean, you know, yes, I think AI will continue to improve, 100%. But as AI writes more and more code and people aren't doing as much of, like, hand-rolling things, like, do you even care? I mean, you're not looking at what code is being produced.
Yeah, I would also ask this question, right? Has quality ever mattered? If you think about all the code bases you've been in, has quality ever really mattered?
That's actually a good question, man. That's a brilliant question. How many, I mean, think about it. I mean, I already know what you're going to say, but every project we've been involved in over our career, it always comes down to that. It always comes down to a trade-off discussion. Do you want me to do this right, or do you want me to just get it done?
Nope.
Right? So getting back on topic here, because I do want to focus on the project failures. One thing I do remember that we did that was probably a misstep on our part. Do you remember when we initially implemented Dapper?
Oh yeah.
So for the people watching, listening that don't know, Dapper is a micro object relational mapper. If you're familiar with databases, then there are approaches where you can bring in code that will map a class to a table in your database. And traditionally, they're called entities. So at first, we pulled in Dapper because Dapper is lightweight. It's micro ORM. You know, we figured, oh, this will be faster, you know, more efficient. But I vividly remember Hollywood was having to kind of write all of this logic to get the data, you know, and kind of writing all these ways to do these joins and get this data back and present it to the front end in an easy way. And so that ended up taking a lot of his capacity, right? And so eventually, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Hollywood, we ripped Dapper out and we just put in Entity Framework just because we wanted to kind of get to an MVP state, right? Am I missing something?
I'm not sure. I don't think we ever ripped it out. I think when we were doing it, EF Core, remember, we were using .NET Core, and .NET Core was really in, like, its infancy, if I can say. Like, nope. I think it was at 2.1 or 3.1 or something like that. It was still mm-hmm. fairly, like, young. And then mm-hmm. we were kind of talking very technical. So .NET is a whole framework. C Sharp, which is a programming language, and they have .NET's been around for a good while, and they have this thing that they call the full framework, which is .NET 4 or 4.6 or whatever was the latest at that time. But they were rewriting their whole .NET framework, making it open source and everything like that, making it cross-platform as well, so it works on not just Windows machines but Linux machines. And so they read they had to be at 2.1 or like 3.0 when we were using it, and EF Core. I think this was at least my first EF project outside of EF6 from the full framework. And the way I would describe the differences between EF6 and EF Core was EF6 let you make all the mistakes you wanted to make. It would let you do bad design and things like that. So if you started with that, which I did, and I got all my learnings from that, but I go into EF Core and I can't do some of the things I think I can do, right? It's all client-side evaluation, right. All this other stuff, right? It's terrible.
I don't think
we ever ripped EF Core out. I think we did stick with Dapper, but at that point, the project was kind of coming to an end too.
Yeah. I think in hindsight, maybe we would have, do you think we would have moved a little quicker had we just gone with EF Core?
Oh yeah, 100%. I'm not a SQL guy. Okay. I shouldn't be.
I will say, man, I would say I was actually pretty impressed with some of the queries you were writing, because I mean, me kind of focusing on other things, like I was just able to call your method, so I was like, oh, this is awesome, you know. You were doing all the legwork.
And see, the thing about it is, right, it was fast though. Right, Dapper is fast. I mean, it's basically just SQL, right? Like it don't have all the baggage that comes with, you know, Entity Framework or whatever. So that was my whole thing. We got to make this fast. And again, I've matured over time, so I've kind of learned that there needs to be trade-offs. But you know, for me, I'm like, I want everything, right? Because you were talking about Matt. He was like, you have two of the three. Hey, I want it all, right? And so that's the immaturity coming in where it's like, man, I want to be fast. I wanted to be within our time frame, you know, I wanted to be good quality and just trying to accomplish all that. It does take a lot of time.
Yeah. 100%. Okay. All right. Moving on from Coder Dojo. I wanted to talk about another failed project because, you know, we're talking about projects that we've been involved with, but I also kind of wanted to take it to an enterprise scale, right? To show like, hey, it's not just the regular people out here failing either, you know. So did some research, and before I even go into this article that I found, I'm gonna ask you, Hollywood, have you ever heard of Google Wave? Have you ever even heard of it in the past?
Nope, not until you brought it up.
Me either. I was literally like, I was like, man, you know, it would be cool to like see a use case of like another failed project, and then I'm like, Google Wave, never even heard about it. So I found this article where it talks about Google Wave. And basically, Google Wave was essentially, if I had to think of kind of a competitor of what Google Wave would be, Slack. So it was supposed to be like a centralized workspace platform, you know, where you could collaborate. Let's see here. These are some of the key features in this article. Wiki style functionality. While this product was supposed to replace your regular email, it had an interesting feature that all users added to the Wave would be able to edit that document. So that was one key feature. Drag and drop file uploads. Instead of having to search for a file, attach it separately, and then send your email, you could easily add files to your conversation just by dropping them where they were needed. Another key feature, playback. One of the worst things about being added to an email thread late is that you miss out on all of the previous conversations. With Google Wave, you can quickly scroll back up and see how the entire discussion progressed, making it easy to catch up on anything you missed. Now, for context, Google Wave was supposed to be released in 2009. So I do need to add that context because some of you guys are probably listening to me and saying, drag and drop file upload, like, that's easy, right? But this was 09. So times were different. I don't even know if Slack existed back then.
I think so.
Yeah, because, man, I have no idea. Or even if Google Chat did exist, I'm sure it wasn't what it is today with this capability.
I don't even think that was around. That's a good question. We should probably go look that up.
I know. We should look that up. But anyway, so it was supposed to be this big thing, and basically it completely flopped. And going through this article, there were some assumptions that were made that led to the downfall of Google Wave, and maybe you'll resonate with some of these. So one bad assumption that they made was Wave was a finished product at the time of its release. It was always an R&D project. Wave was a beta release in the word's true sense, not an almost finished product with beta put on it in excess of caution. Another failed assumption is users would adopt Wave quickly. Once new users gained access to the platform, the enthusiasm faded quickly and was replaced by confusion. Another failed assumption, it would be easy to add users to Wave. This was one of the most flawed concepts of the whole design. For a collaborative app to have trouble adding users is a serious problem. I completely agree with that. The key point, though, out of this entire article that I want to call out is this once this one little blurb that was in the article, and it says this. One of the main problems with Wave was that hardly anyone knew what a Wave was or what to do with it. With barely any introduction of Wave concepts to the general public, next to no marketing and no specific commercial targeting, this product was practically set up for failure. Now, I'm going to say this. How many times have we worked on a project where we didn't do any validation, no marketing, no defining what your target audience is? You just hit the road running, you start coding, and in your mind, you're like, man, this is going to blow up. This is going to be awesome. Man, I'm going to have 100,000 users on this thing. And you put it out there. And I'll be honest, like, I've done this before. I don't even know how to market or do advertisement. I haven't even thought for that. Haven't budgeted for it at all. You drop a link somewhere on social media. You try to hit up a couple people on Reddit. And you quickly find out nobody cares.
True.
And it seems like that is exactly what happened with Google Wave. They basically built this thing without doing any work in front of it, and they fell on their faces.
Yeah, man, that's I'll say, man, big companies, they can afford to do that, though. It's kind of like the modern content creation these days, right? Which is funny because we're actually in content creation, where it's like you create content and you just put it out there, and then maybe it hits, maybe it doesn't. I almost kind of describe it like, kind of taking it to hip hop, right? The mixtapes. One of the things that like, you know, 50 Cent did very well was he put a lot of mixtapes out there, Lil Wayne, same way, right? And, Wayne, you know, they hit on, and then next thing you know, boom, hey, I'm checking for other things. And so, but big companies come bringing it back to that. I feel like they have the budget and they have the time to do it because, you know, they lost, obviously, they invested money in it. And those people who worked on it, they probably learned a lot from it, by the way. But they got paid for that time versus us, like, on the side. And we do stuff like that. Like, we put it out there. Hey, nobody, it doesn't catch on. That's a lot of time that we just put into something that didn't really reward us. And financially, I would say. Because a lot of things we do doesn't have to be rewarding financially. But I think big companies can do it. Oh, and let me give you a fact. So I just looked it up. Slack wasn't released until 2013.
Wow.
Yep.
So yeah, because we were you're right. Because when we were at RSI, we didn't have Slack. We were on Yammer. You remember that? We were on Yammer and Google Chat, and that was back when it was called Hangouts.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? No, they had us on Yammer, bro. Wow. We're showing.
Hey, is Yammer still around? So Yammer, for those who don't know, Yammer was supposed to be like, or it's marketed as Twitter for work. That nobody ever used.
I didn't even know that. Yeah. Man, after I left RSI, I've never gone anywhere and they were like, we use Yammer. Oh, man, that was funny.
But that's interesting, though
that late.
Yeah, 2013. So you talking about Google Wave came out. So if you really think about it, I guess the cost of innovation is apparently evident here, right? Because they came out with all these things that Slack, you know, does very well, or at least did very well. We don't use that word, but it does very well. And so it's like, man, that's kind of crazy, right? Like, maybe they released at the wrong time when the industry wasn't ready for it. That may require a use case analysis.
Oh, I know. Oh, we might be able to get into some use case analysis stuff on the podcast too, man. That would be dope, actually. Maybe we did like a walkthrough one, but whatever. I'm going off topic here. That brings up I have a random question. Do you think it's just more cost effective? And I don't know the cost specifically. But do you think it's just easier for a company to go with Google Workspace. Because, and the reason I ask that is because I find that a lot of the companies I've been at, they use Google, you know, like when we were at RSI, when I was at Wix, Google Workspace. Do you guys use Google Workspace?
Yeah, we've had two different experiences. Actually, RSI may have been the only company I worked at that used Google for their email.
Really?
Most of it is, or the rest of them have been Outlook.
Yeah, and see, me, I'm actually not the biggest fan of Outlook, man.
I'm not the biggest fan of email, though, so.
True story. So are you guys using, like, Teams?
Chats?
Teams, like, yeah. Gotcha. Yep. Oh, in your defense, I will say my current company, they use Outlook and Teams, but they're Microsoft, like, all the way, like, I mean, Azure, all that stuff, man. So I thought that maybe they were a little biased. I'm not gonna lie.
No, if you think about it, if you're the company, you might be, because the way I look at it is that, I mean, Google, do they have even a programming language? Go is Go.
Like, Go, yeah. And Go, oh, okay. And Go is fire, in my opinion.
Yeah. So the reason why I bring it up is because, like, a lot of shops I work at or have worked at have been like .NET shops, Amazon being like a Java shop, I think, for the most part. But outside that's been .NET. And if you think about Microsoft, the whole ecosystem of Microsoft just kind of synergizes fairly well. So with Google, I feel like Google is more of an outlier when it comes to like emails and Workspace and things like that, because that's kind of it, right? They don't own the OS. Like, Microsoft owns the OS.
Yeah.
In my opinion, the best browser out there right now is actually Microsoft Edge. This is not a paid advertisement. I don't really care.
I don't know.
I do know that Chrome was hogging so many resources, man. It just annoyed me one day because I'm writing code and taking all my resources. I'm like, this is a bull, right? So I go and I was like, let me just open this up in Edge. And I'm using Edge, and like, the experience is nice. It actually synchronizes or synergizes with Teams very well. I'm like, I have really no reason to go back, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Man, that's very interesting. I still need to give it a chance. I will say I haven't really given Edge a fair shot. I got hooked on Chrome and I've been hooked ever since. So I need to take a step back, maybe take a look at Edge and see what you're talking about. See if the hype is real, man. See if the hype is real.
When it first came out, it wasn't good, right? I think they were using their own drivers and things like that. But now they're based on Chromium, which Chrome is based on Chromium, right? And so now Microsoft adds their own little flavor to it and things like that. So that's my preference.
Okay. All right. Cool. Bet. One thing I did want to touch on really quick that you talked about is big companies have the budget to kind of make those failures, right? And so I kind of wanted to pick your brain and say, like, have you ran into that before? Because I have, right? Where I've been, you know, either a part of a project or maybe I was on another project, but I knew a team that was working on a project. And the project just gets shelved, you know? It gets shelved and people just kind of, they do the Homer Simpson gif where they kind of, you know, kind of back into the bush and just act like it never happened, you know? And to your point, it's kind of like they can afford to do that, you know? So from a company standpoint, like, it's not that deep, right? But I feel like when you're an IC and you're seeing that, especially as an engineer, like, I imagine that can kind of grind your gears.
Yeah, I've actually never experienced it. I don't think that it would bother me. I actually think that I would embrace that, right? Embrace the opportunity to go out and build something that may or may not be adopted. That in my head is like, hey, I can build this to the standards that I have for myself and my team, versus being under some type of deadline or pressure to deliver something that is most definitely going to go out into production, right? Building a prototype, building a proof of concept. I embrace those opportunities. But what I have experienced is more of changing priorities. That's what grinds my gears. It's like, hey, this is the high priority for this next 3 months. And then after 3 months, the priority has changed to something else. Now, this is not the next highest priority. Now it's this. Or you get multiple high priorities. Yep. Or they change the priorities during the priorities. That's what really grinds my.
Yeah. I have a saying, which is, if there are multiple high priorities, there are no high priorities.
There are no high priorities, bro. There are no high
priorities. Yeah. And they get frustrated at you, too. Man. Oh, I know. Especially, like program managers. I don't know if y'all have those, but I've at Wex, we had program managers. In my opinion, like I have to kind of sit back and go, okay, what do you do? Because we're in these calls and basically you're just asking me questions and I'm not giving you the answers you're looking for. So, you know, what do you do besides how me, you know?
Yeah.
You know, hey, is what it is. I will say this though, as a rebuttal, I'm gonna move off of that. But I will say this rebuttal though. I knew this guy and he had this term shelfware, and I will say I do not like the idea of like building shelfware. I don't enjoy being on a project where like it feels like I'm kind of in a desert and there are like tumbleweeds going by because nobody's really like talking about it, you know, and you're just kind of looking around like, is anyone interested in this? You know, and because I enjoy building something that I know is going to be of value, you know? So, like, when I feel like I'm just building something and, like, you're just kind of looking around, nobody's really talking about it, or maybe you're working on something and people are talking about it, but then all of a sudden people are like, oh, yeah, we're just going to kind of move on, you know? I'm kind of like, well, was this, like, I want to do something that's, like, of value, you know?
Yeah, I guess my perspective is different because I feel like we've never, ever gotten a credit as back-end engineers, right? Because if you think about when they're trying to sell a product, they're only selling the front end, right? It has to look good. Fair. It has to fit a workflow. Yeah. And so the people who I feel like are the engines to the train, mm-hmm. right? Nobody cares about the engine, right? Nobody looks at the engine, but the train is shiny. They're gonna navigate towards it, and so I don't think that I've ever been in a situation where we've ever gotten credit for the work that we've done, and I accepted it a while ago where it's like, hey, you know, I'm not doing this for the credit, I'm doing this to get some value out of it for myself, and hopefully my team is getting some value out of the code that we write, because a lot of the stuff that we write just for our viewers, you really never see. We are very, very, very proud of, right? Like those people who built ChatGPT, you don't know the behind the scenes, right? You don't see none of that, but you just appreciate, it gives me this information. It helps me do this job. So I kind of have that mentality where, hey, we've never gotten it. I don't expect it. And as long as I get something out of it, I'm good.
And I can imagine working at a place like AWS, right? Like I can only imagine like the different systems and all the amount of data, like the volume of data being transferred between systems, and how are services communicating? How are you guys making sure that things are consistent or eventually consistent, whatever approach you guys are using? So, to your point, when it comes to back end, that stuff, people don't see that, right? But it's like extremely complex, dog. Like it's extremely complex.
Yeah.
Okay, bet. So, now we can kind of go into what are some things that we would do differently, whether it's Coder Dojo, whether it's a bigger company, you know, that maybe made a mistake. What are some, like, in your mind, what are some things that you think anyone could do to try to be better next time, the next go around they work on a project?
So to answer your question, right, like going back to Matt Roberts, he taught me like two things that were very, very important. He taught me a lot, but those two things that I really, really gonna go back to. And the first thing is documentation, learning how to read documentation and understand it. Because I can go to him with questions, and I always went to him with questions, and he could obviously answer it. He would answer. He had a lot of patience, but he would also show me, hey, this is where it is in documentation. This is how you read it. This is how you study it. And so that's been very, very valuable. But the second thing that goes back to your question is he told me to ask questions. He told me about the five whys. and how important the five whys were. And this was back in 2014, 15, somewhere around there. Before, you know, Amazon CEO turned the coin YQ, have a high YQ. I've been knowing about the five whys for a long time. And so the way he described it to me, he told me this story. He said there was a daughter who was watching her mom cook a roast. And she noticed that she would cut the ends of her roast off before she put it in the pot. And so her daughter asked her, hey, why do you do this? And she didn't have an answer for her. So she said, the only thing I have for you is that my mom always did it. So she went back and she asked her mom. And her mom pretty much told her the same thing. Well, I did it because my mom did it. But he went back, you know, asked her mom. And her mom said, baby, the only reason why I did it is because my pot was too small. Right. And so the moral of that story is sometimes we're out here doing a lot of things that we don't understand why we're doing it. And it doesn't make sense to do. So all these years, you know, that mother's been wasting a good portion of her meat by cutting the ends off when, you know, she could have just really understood why it's important to turn, you know, cut those ends off and go forward from there. But I think we have that fault in a lot of our projects at work and on the side projects, which is we don't ask enough questions. Nobody should be offended by the question. There was this instance in the group chat that we talked about on Facebook, the Black Tech Network Facebook group.
Yes.
Where there was a question coming up about, hey, my manager, I asked them, you know, why they made some changes to my code. And they didn't really explain why. They just went and did it. They didn't really respond. And they were looking for some advice. And so kind of summarize the advice I gave them was that, you know, keep asking questions and keep moving forward. If that manager doesn't have the time to explain to you or doesn't want to explain why they're making the changes that they're making, you shouldn't feel any type of way about it. That's on that manager. And I see it like this. If you can't explain what you do and why you do it or why you wrote something the way you wrote it, you shouldn't be able to do it. And that goes to all levels. Yeah. This goes beyond like levels and titles and things like that. This sticks to, we're talking about code here. This is software development. This is code. This is all that matters. It doesn't matter who wrote it. And so I think when you talk about what, you know, I would have done differently or what we could have done differently, I think asking more questions is always a good course of action.
Yeah. I think that's a great answer. One follow-up question I have is, how do you thrive, or maybe you don't thrive, but what do you do in an environment where maybe you ask a lot of questions, but you're met with a lot of pushback, right? So people start to view you as, oh, you're being the squeaky wheel, or, just, you know, because I said so, you know, I am the leader here. You're the, you know, you're the worker bee. Just do what I say.
Yeah. How do I handle? You know, man, that's a tough one because I experienced tough, that currently, right? This is not a situation you asked me about that I have overcame. I would say my response has changed multiple times, kind of depending on, you know, how I approach the situation. I stick to this principle. I still ask the question, right? Because they're important. At the end of the day, all that matters is work. Not really how you feel about it, how you feel about me. It's all about the work. We work in a fact-based field, right? If you do something a certain way, it will work. And if you don't do something a certain way, it will not work. We work in a fact-based field. Right. So if I'm asking you questions, I'm asking you questions to get to the fact of the matter. I don't need a theory, right? I don't need to know how you feel about it. I just need an answer. I need to understand why the decision was made, how it was made, or why the approach. And if you tell me the why, if I have a better understanding, and as I mentioned before, the context matters, and I get more of the context, I can actually build a better product for you than you giving me surface level information and just expecting me to go with that.
Yeah. You're preaching to the choir. Hopefully, the listeners out there, someone who's potentially dealing with that, maybe that they have a good takeaway from that.
Yeah.
One thing that I see often, because you know, I've I watch these YouTube videos on these SaaS, these people that have started these SaaS businesses. And one thing they really harp on a lot is validating your idea. What are your thoughts on that? Because I feel like I have a middle of the ground opinion. Like, I feel like, absolutely, like, validate the idea. Make sure, like, hey, is this something that people can actually use and benefit from, if that's your goal, right? Like, if your goal is, hey, I'm just trying to build software and I'm just trying to learn about this technology, I say you just hit the ground running, because even if it doesn't work out, like, there was still value on your end from it, right? But if you are truly trying to build something that, like, I want this to be a successful thing that makes money, 100%, like, I'm like, yeah, validate. But I also feel like at some point, you know, I do feel like you have to get something into users' hands. So what are your thoughts on when people really harp on validating an idea?
And what do they mean by validate?
So I've seen a couple different approaches. I would say the top two or three. One to me is almost, well, I don't even know how valid that is, because one approach I've seen is people say, oh, reach out to your network. And I'm like, all right, well, I mean, everybody has a different kind of network. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. If you're talking to someone, you know, 5 years of experience, maybe they've worked at smaller companies. Like, I mean, depending on their network, like, they might be talking to people that don't care, you know, and they ask them the question. They're like, man, I don't have that domain knowledge to confidently answer if I would use your app. I wouldn't be a user of it, you know? So that's one thing I've seen. Another thing I've seen is building landing pages where you kind of just express the idea and then you try to get people to sign up, and then you basically market or advertise that. So that way you can see if you can get interested people before you start to build. And another thing I've seen too is kind of building out some sort of wireframe or some sort of, like, very lightweight workflow where you can, like, show what the workflow would be, but it's not a full-fledged application. And then taking that and then trying to pub that out.
Gotcha. Ooh. That's a tough one, man, because at the end of the day, everything you saying, right, costs time. It may not cost money, right, but it costs some level of time.
Right.
I think what I do if I'm going into a side project, I probably do one or two things. I'm either just gonna, mm-hmm. you know, hit the ground running, just go dive into it, and get to a point where I've convinced myself that this is not a good idea, or it's not worth it. Or I'm gonna run it by, you know, people like you and my other people. Like, hey, what do you think about mm-hmm. this? Think this would, you know, catch on? Or what about this idea, and kind of validate it that mm-hmm. way? But as far as kind of going out there mm-hmm. and putting it out there and saying, hey, can I get you all's opinion on this, and kind of get a group of following, and then going out there and building something? I don't think that would be my approach. Maybe that should be, because I don't have anything that's, you know, making money right now. So, you know, maybe yeah. I need to change up my strategy. But for now, that's not yeah. really something I think I would do. That'd be my approach.
Yeah, yeah. And I think too, man, like I mean, we're passionate about technology and coding. So I think for us it's always like, even if it flops, I still got something out of it, right? Like I was able to, like, work with these technologies, work with this tooling, you know, and now, and I, you know, candidly speaking, I'm just gonna say this, I'm gonna put it on my resume. You know, like, I'm gonna be like, oh yeah, I got experience with this, I did this at work, you know. Facts. But we've done it to the point where I can speak to it, you know? So yep. Guess what?
Exactly.
The story might not be true, but like you said, we work in a fact-based industry. So I'm just spitting the facts to you. You know what I'm saying? So at that point, does the story matter that much? You know?
That's fact. So that actually brings up a good point, because I worked on side projects where I built, like, multiple microservices, right? This whole domain-driven yep. architecture and things like yep. that. Built this whole whole system, right? It was actually called a Black Excellence mm-hmm. Project. It was kind of supposed to follow off Facebook and things like that. It's a whole bunch of microservices yeah. behind it. very difficult to maintain by one person, just to be very, very clear.
Yeah.
But before I've done that, I've never actually worked on microservices. And so when I got into interviews at like Amazon and at the company I currently work with now, you know, I could speak towards microservices because I actually did it. I never did it professionally, but I actually did it. And I think this is an important detail to kind of note to people who are going out there and trying to get into this field and saying, hey, well, I don't actually have the experience. I said before, you worked in a fact-based industry. So you may not have the experience professionally or in a corporate way. But if you put this work in on the side and you can speak to it, I've never, ever thought that I have an idea where I would go and say, hey, this person, I'm interviewing this person and they know exactly what I need them to know, but I can't hire you because you don't have a degree. I don't think that would ever be my approach. And I don't think that would be most people's approaches to hiring talent.
Facts.
The talent's the talent.
Facts. 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 And I you bring up a great point because I actually tell people that today, like, for example, my barber. He's actually trying to get, now he's not trying to get into coding per se. He's trying to get more into cybersecurity, I believe. But we had a similar conversation where I was telling him, I was like, you don't need a degree, man. You don't need a degree. Like, sure, certs, you know, go get your certs. But once you get your certs, man, and granted, I don't know as much about cybersecurity, so let me also add that context, but I'm not sure if there's a way that you can participate in some sort of side project or something, or kind of just build up your skills on the side in such a way that, you know, you can land an interview because you have that skill set despite you not having a degree, you know? And I'm also a proponent of, look, now, no, I'm not saying you should just go and just lie to the 10th degree on your resume. You know, I'm not saying, you know, if you haven't met, I don't know, if you haven't met Jay-Z, don't put on your resume, oh, I met Jay-Z. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, I mean, look, man, I'm sure a lot of people listening or watching, you guys have probably done it as well, where you have, you know, you laid it on thick in your resume. And that's what I'm saying. Like, if you've done it on the side, lay it on thick according to whatever the job is asking for. And as long as you can confidently speak to what they're asking you about, I don't think it really matters, you know? And I think if you were to tell your job down the line after you're hired, hey, you know, I lied about da 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 da, it'll be like, we don't care. You knew the stuff, you know, you knew the technologies, you knew the domain. Now, I'm not saying just don't go and tell your job that, but I'm just saying.
hey, you know, experience is experience, right? Like at the end of the day, experience is experience, and you should get credit for all the experience, no matter how you got it. And to be perfectly honest, none of the school experience that you get is going to be as valuable as the experience that you're going to get from actually doing the work. So.
Man, that's a quote right there, man. That's a quote.
Book it.
So, okay, cool. Yeah. Hey, you got it. Yeah, that's gotta be a real man. But, so with all that being said, I'm gonna wrap us up here. So kind of taking us to our takeaways, a few quick lessons that I have here. Number one, you're not behind, you're learning. So whatever it is, whether you're dealing, you know, whether you just came up off a project that failed, maybe you're dealing with something at work where you feel like, man, I'm just not picking this up. Maybe you run into a hard technical problem. I had that happen recently. And you just feel like you're stumped in the moment. You're not behind. You're learning. Shiny ideas fade. Pick something you care about. Solve a problem. Don't create a solution. So number one, make sure it's something that you care about, you're passionate about. We're passionate about coding. So for us, when we work on something, whether it takes off to the moon, whether nobody ever uses it, we feel rewarded because we love coding, you know. So make sure whatever you're doing, you care about it. If you want to make money, make sure you're solving a problem, not creating a solution that nobody cares about. And then lastly, the process is the product when you're learning. That workflow you're dealing with and you're constantly, okay, all right, it goes like this, but we need to make it like da 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 da. And you're constantly like changing things and manipulating how maybe the UI works or maybe what the process is or when a user might get a notification. That's all the product, you know, and the process that you're going through is developing that product. And what's the old saying? Hollywood, eat your own dog food. So, you know, when you when you create that product, you know, make sure that, you know, you're testing it, that you're using it, you know, like it doesn't make sense to put something out there in the world if you don't even know it, you can't speak to it, you can't explain it. And even beyond just a side project, when you're at work, that's something Hollywood actually taught me. Like, even in your job, like you need to know what you're working on. You need to be able to speak to the code that you're writing. You need to be able to speak to the application that you're maintaining, and know its pitfalls, know the tech debt, know the highs, the lows, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And my last takeaway is what the title said. Failure is not final. You messed up. It's all good. Get down 7 times, get back up again. So, fun question to close here. Hollywood, if your past self came to you, pitching to you working on Coder Dojo today, what advice would you give them if they were approached by someone else about working on Coder Dojo?
My advice would be to, one, make sure you have a direct line of communication. Make sure you have a consistent line of communication. Make sure you agree on a RACI model, roles and responsibilities, basically, or who owns what, who needs to be aware of what, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's my biggest thing. I would keep the communication very, very frequent, very, very open, and very, very clear. And I think if you do that, then you all will land somewhere. It may not be where you want to land, but we will land somewhere where we are aligned with, versus, you know, we're landing in one place that we viewed it as unfair, and I'm pretty sure that they viewed it as unfair as well.
I've seen the powerful fall when the people work together as one. I need you to live or let die. Hold your head high. I'm by your side till it's one. Together we can hold.